Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Microsoft Chief Creative Architect, Ben Rudolph. Ben, welcome.
Hey, John. Good to hear from you again. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's nice to have you on the show. You are sort of a marketing chief at Microsoft. Is that right?
Yeah, you bet.
For consumers.
That's a good way to put it. My team... the best way I can put it is we tell the stories and we build the experiences that turn shoppers and sellers into fans of Microsoft. So my team looks after kind of everything to do with how the Microsoft brand and the Microsoft product suite shows up to consumers in a retail environment. So imagine if you walked into a Best Buy or a Dixon's or a Fnac.
Or even a Microsoft store, perhaps.
It's interesting. We do a lot of work with the Microsoft Store. The Microsoft Store tends to work a lot with they're obviously our first-party retail. We tend to do most of our work with our third-party retailers. So all of our partners that sell Microsoft products and services around the world, and there are thousands of those. We obviously partner very, very closely with the Microsoft Stores, but they have a slightly different approach since they're a first-party shop.
All right, cool. Well, I want to get into that, and I want to get into some Microsoft stuff and things that you guys are doing that I'm fond of in the second half of the show. But I wanted to ask you, as I do with all the guests, how did all this get started? What were you thinking about in your early years, even before I got to know you at Parallels?
Yeah, you bet. I was going to be a doctor.
Really?
That's what I went to school to be. Absolutely. Because that's in the Rudolph family, that's what you do. You become a doctor. We have a family of physicians. My grandfather was a doctor. My dad, one of his brothers, uncles, their kids. I mean, if you go to a Rudolph family reunion, anything from a sore throat to a gunshot wound, we can pretty much handle. I was in school at the George Washington University, and I was always a kind of a science-minded guy. And I got a job over the summer between my sophomore and junior year working in a biotechnology lab that was actually run by two guys who were former camp counselors of mine, of all things. And I was going to go work in the lab and get experience for medical school. And I showed up, and I worked in the lab for a week, and I just hated it. It was just I couldn't get into it. It was the grinding kind of slow pace. I have nothing but respect for people who do that kind of work. But I realized very, very early on that this was not going to be for me. So I went to my boss, a guy named Colin at the time, and I said, Colin, just to give you an idea of how long Colin and I have known each other, I said, you're my job for the summer, and I can't work in this lab anymore because I hate it. But you better find something for me to do or my mom's going to kill both of us. I remember him saying, well, we're trying to, keep the lab going. We want to raise our profile. So a really great way to do that is to go do PR for the lab. So go do that. And I said,
oh, I can see it coming.
I don't know how to do that. And Colin said, well, I don't know how to do it either. So go figure it out. And, I started my career in PR. I went out, I made some contacts, I got us some stories, and we got a couple of big stories. And Colin said, congratulations, you're running PR and marketing for Aptigen. So my junior and senior year, I was working just about full time, managing PR and comms and marketing for the company. Off I went.
This was at George Washington.
Yeah, exactly. It's George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
So what was your final major then? Did you switch?
Actually, I always had a liberal arts major. I have an art history degree, of all things, a biology minor, because in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was in school, it was very much in fashion for medical schools to accept people with liberal arts degrees. The thinking for them was, look, we'll teach you how to be a doctor. We'll teach you the science that you need. We want people who are good communicators and good critical thinkers. And certainly in the career choice that I chose, it actually turned out to be a really good major choice.
Was there any pain involved in this? Because I've gone through a little bit of this myself, and I've talked to other people who've done it. Sometimes this transition takes a long time where there's a period of agony and self-introspection. Sometimes it's just like ignition point. You go, aha, This is it. No more reflection needed.
Yeah, I think the latter was very much true for me. I mean, there was a very short mourning period because from the time I was little, I just always assumed that I would be the next Dr. Rudolph. You know, that path was just laid out for me very, very early.
Did your parents put a lot of pressure on you, or was it just inspirational on your part because of your family?
They did put a little bit of pressure on me. I don't think it was a pressure to necessarily follow in my father's footsteps. It was more of the pressure to, you know, use the opportunities that I was given and use the natural talents I was blessed with to the fullest of my capacity and to my ability. And I know with my parents, when I went into the marketing and the PR world, that's a very foreign world to them. You know, my dad was a dermatologist for, 40 years, I think. He just retired about a year ago. I think it was 40 years, 41 years. My mom ran the practice. So this kind of abstract world of, yeah, I'm trying to build fans and convince people to buy stuff, they didn't really get that. Even through my time at Parallels, I'll say the only job that they really understand is my job now, because I work for Microsoft and they know that Microsoft is a nice, solid, reputable company. You know, the lights aren't going to go off anytime soon. I don't think they still fully understand what I do, but they know I at least work for a solid A-level company.
Yeah, it takes a unique personality to be able to connect with people, to be an extrovert, to be sensitive to people's problems, to listen to how, you know, they describe their problems and to sell them on your solution, and do it in a way that is professional and productive and not seemingly self-serving just to, you know, make a buck. That's a fine art.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my mentors here said, people love to buy. They hate to be sold to.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I've heard that before. That's a good motto.
It's a really good motto, because people love, you know, especially in the world that you and I are in and have been in for so long, you know, the stuff that we get access to that regular people do not get access to is pretty profound, and our level of expertise is very high. So you have to strike that balance between what I would call like solution selling, you know, understanding the problem and helping them come up with a great solution, plus technical expertise, plus empathy towards just, you know, you connecting with another human being.
Exactly.
I find that to be the most interesting piece of my job, not just in the campaigns and the creative that we do, but my team also looks after the retail professional community. So anybody who works in a store who sells Microsoft products and services, how do we build connections with them so that they feel like they're part of the Microsoft family?
Absolutely.
And they can advocate for us and advocate for the products and, you know, help people find the right product and solution that's going to make their life a little bit better.
So you graduate from George Washington University. We have a liberal arts degree. But you probably needed to take some extra steps over and above your internship into this business of marketing. Did you jump right into Parallels, or were there some intermediate steps?
Well, there were some intermediate steps. After Aptogen, unfortunately, you know, the company closed. We fell prey to what so many biotech companies and so many technology companies did, which is we had a really interesting set of IP. And then other people developed similar IP and they could do the work for cheaper and faster. And we couldn't keep up. And the company eventually just, you know, shut down. I did my own thing for a little bit. I was a consultant with a lot of small, medium businesses around the DC area for about 2 years or so.
How did you do that? How did you sell yourself as a consultant?
Well, I had a very strong presence in the DC business scene because of the work that I was doing with Aptogen. Aptogen was an up-and-coming company.
The magic connection.
Exactly. I did a lot of public speaking. I was actually an on-air analyst for BBC World News on biotech and genomic engineering and things like that. So I had a fairly decent presence, even though I was a pretty young guy.
Listeners, are you paying attention to this?
Exactly. So it was a fairly easy transition for me to find people who said, I love what you did for Aptogen. Can you do a similar thing to me?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The very hard part was running my own business, which I was not prepared for at all.
Was that because you weren't able to manage and juggle the, both the finances and the online presence and the footwork, or what?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think on the creative side, the storytelling side, the work I was doing for clients, I was lights out. I could do great work for them. Managing payment schedules and invoices and expenses, and to your point, you know, going out and doing business development and managing those three aspects of the business, I think I wasn't emotionally mature enough to handle all of those things. I loved the creative work, but the, you know, the block and tackle stuff of making sure you pay your bills and your taxes on time, I didn't like doing. So, you know, it always got backburnered, and I was always in this perpetual state where I was unhappy because I was felt like I had to do that stuff, and it was taking time away from the stuff I wanted to do. It's just a young person's take on what it took to run a business.
And let me ask you a second, because I know the listeners are just burning to hear. Were you into Windows and PCs at this point? Is that how you fell into it and stayed there, or were you using Macs at this point in Excel?
I was always a Windows guy. You know, I was DOS user. I was a Windows 3.1 guy. I was a Windows 95 beta tester. I was pretty deep in the Windows world.
How did you do that? Because back in the Windows 3.1 days, the transition from DOS to Windows, Apple was pretty famous. You know, John Skelly was running the company, and Apple was making a big deal and running a lot of TV ads about this wonderful little, you know, graphics user interface and this mouse and this cute little Macintosh thing. And that was hard to resist. That was very technically alluring.
It was. I think it was because, you know, there was a guy named George Defendahl who helped my dad implement his first computer system at his office. And as part of that, we got a PC for the house, kind of the same one that was in the office. And so he taught me, you know, he said, like, look, here's how you work off the DOS command line. And I had some games that I could play and I could do all that. You know, I learned that stuff. I mean, I will say, I think it was in elementary school. I learned to type on an Apple in our schools. That was the first computer I ever used.
So it really is true, and I'm seeing this with many of the guests. The first computer you use as youth sort of sets you for life. That's that first computer learning experience. That's why everybody's so big on education. Mm-hmm. So we want to get those products in front of the kids at an early age and get them hooked.
Absolutely. I mean, and there's getting them people comfortable with the ecosystem, but teaching them the life skills that they need. I mean, you need to know how to use a computer. You need to know how to type. You need to know how to use things like Microsoft Office. Like those are standardized pieces of software and equipment that the world runs on. And you just need to know, if you don't know how to use those things, you are at a disadvantage for the rest of your life.
Right. Right. So you worked small business for a while. You were a little frustrated with the details, then what?
That's exactly right. Then I went to a small business intelligence company in the D.C. area, because I was at the spot where I was making okay money working for myself, not great money. And I was like, I'm ready to go back into the corporate world. I'd like health insurance. I'd like all that stuff.
You were like Steve Jobs. You went into the wild and then came back into the fold. Right?
Exactly. I worked in the business intelligence world. Great company, really good people. A lot of the people who work at that company are still good friends of mine. But I realized enterprise software wasn't really where my heart was. I loved the consumer side of things. I was much more of a consumer technical guy. So I was looking around at other companies, and I interviewed for a company called SWSoft, and to be a product manager for one of their virtualization products. And you can see where this is going. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed, and you know, it was a really interesting interview path, because I interviewed with the CEO of the company, and then I interviewed with some of the venture capitalists that were backing the company. And I was thinking to myself, man, this is really weird. Like, I'm just, you know, this is kind of like this junior mid-level product marketing position. And eventually I got a call from one of the senior people there saying, hey, I just want to give you a heads up. We can't offer you this job. And I was kind of about to lose my temper. I'd taken days off from work. I'd been through all these hoops, and I was pretty upset. And he goes, but there's this other company that we're partnering with called Parallels. you know, they're a group of engineers right now, and they really need somebody with your skill set to help launch the company and establish the brand.
This must have been about, what, 2001 or two?
No, this is later than that. This is 2005, I think. It's 2005.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because Parallels was relatively new when we launched the Desktop for Mac product. We were only about a year and a half or so in. Yeah, so they said to me, look, we need somebody who's a, you know, a great marketer, a great communicator to help build a comms plan, a launch plan, and get the products out the door and set up shop and build a business. And we'd love to work with you on that job. And I said, well, I don't really know what those guys do, but it seems interesting. It's probably better than what I got right now. So sure, what the heck, I'm in.
And that's when we met.
And that's when we met. And, you know, it was myself, just me by myself in a little rented office in Herndon, Virginia.
What enabled that, if I can just put a parenthesis in here, was is Apple's transition away from PowerPC. We had this kind of a strained version of Microsoft Office, not Office, but Windows. Virtual PC running on PowerPC Macs. And it was kind of slow and a little bit difficult. And when Apple switched over to Intel, all of a sudden the door was open. You could do virtualization. You could run Intel. You could run Microsoft binaries and Microsoft Office all on an x86 Macintosh. And it was glorious. Off and running. Anyway, return from subroutine.
You just summed it up. I mean, we launched the company. We started developing the Mac product, which, you know, I don't think any one of us would have guessed that it was going to be as big or as important as it actually was. You know, we thought, we're like, look, we'll build this product and people will use it if they need it for a, you know, for whatever app they need to run, and we'll get some really great PR. And it went from being this thing that we thought was going to be an interesting idea to, you know, one of the biggest ideas of the middle 2000s. I mean, it was a huge, huge deal.
It was. Well, it's time to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about your current job at Microsoft and then some cool stuff that Microsoft is doing. So, folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. I'm chatting with Microsoft's Ben Rudolph. So Ben, now you took the opportunity to move from Parallels to Microsoft. Did you start off as the chief creative architect?
Definitely not. I came to Microsoft to take what I would say was one of the most challenging jobs at the company, which was enterprise PR for Windows Vista. Which, you know, at the time it was a challenging time, you know, for the company. But I did a lot of work on the Windows blog, a lot of work for both consumer and enterprise PR. A lot of your listeners would probably know me well from the stuff that I did for Windows Phone, where I was in that group for a while. I did the Smoke by Windows Phone and Windows Phone Challenge work, which was a pretty broad scale, multi-country experiential marketing and TV and cinema ad campaign. And I've been over in the retail group for about the last 3 years. So our group, like I said, looks after everything that we do to bring Microsoft's brand and our products and services to life for consumers in retail.
How do you do that structurally? I mean, you talked in the earlier part of the show about for example, Best Buy. Does that involve signage? Does it involve training of salespeople at Best Buy? Tell me more.
Yeah, it actually involves all of those things. So it involves designing the signage that you see on the, we call them the fixtures, the actual tables and displays that we build, everything from what you see on the backer, which is kind of the big poster size thing that's behind all of the devices and the accessories and the PCs, down to how the PCs look on the tables, the placemat, which is the piece of thing, the paper or material that's underneath it that tells you why the PC is so great, and what you can do with it, the fact tags. The fact tags are like where the specs and stuff sits, all the way up to the displays to help you find the right copy of Microsoft Office or the right accessory, the mouse, the keyboard, Windows Store gift cards, Xbox, all of the physical stuff that you experience when you walk into a store, including how we train and inspire the retail professionals to tell the story. Both skill building on how we help them learn to identify what customers need and help them match them with the right device, show them the right demos, and the inspiration piece, giving them the stories that they need to help fall in love with the brand themselves and share that love with all the customers who walk into their store. And then on the flip side, we do the same thing for digital as well. So if you go to the Microsoft Surface page, my team does a lot of work to make that page look, feel, and operate great. And then we partner with our retailers to get that content and the copy up on their pages.
I'm going to ask you a jackpot question here. Hope I'm not prying. You don't have to answer if you don't want to, but here we go. Do you consult with psychologists and design people on your staff to create a certain psychological atmosphere that makes your signage and your setup in the stores somehow seem more as if they're geared towards the customer or visually appealing in some way?
Yeah, it's when you start talking about psychological profiling, it sounds a lot more nefarious than I think
no,
it
no,
actually
no, no.
is.
I just mean good design principles. I mean, absolutely. In terms of the use of color and structure and layout, things like that.
Absolutely. So I have a team of highly trained retail strategists and graphic and experiential designers.
Oh, cool.
Who know everything there is to know about great design principles, what works, what doesn't, the type of copy that you want to use, the type of graphics.
Even the font, I'll bet.
Font, color theory, mm-hmm. semiotic code, which is, you know, the negative space versus, occupied space, how open you want floor plans to be. We also do, as I'm sure you know, we do an enormous amount of testing. We talk to real customers all over the world all the time about, you know, how they feel when they experience the Microsoft brand, when they experience our products and services. So there is an art to this, but there's also a science to it as well. And the things that we've talked to customers about, what we know influences them to make purchasing decisions or the sites they visit on the web or things like that. Like we talk to people in a very, what I would call, a very diverse and inclusive way. You know, Microsoft, like Apple, is a company that works, you know, that serves customers in basically every country on planet Earth. Male and female, young and old, highly educated, minimally educated, all ranges of income levels. So you really need to get a very diverse perspective of how your products and services are being used, how people feel about the products and the brands, so you can build in-store and online experiences that are inclusive for everyone.
Jackpot question again for you. Have you found that customer reaction to the brand of Microsoft has improved dramatically since Satya Nadella took over?
Certainly Satya's had a big role in that. I mean, Satya is he's great. He brings a level of technical excellence to the company, a certain level of cultural change to the company that I think has been very well documented. But also the products are great too. The products have been consistently getting better and better and better. So we have this really interesting kind of confluence of two things, which is a great new leader who's extremely brilliant and very well respected and is, you know, he can see the technology industry in a way that very few other people can. and an engineering team that's building products that are truly, truly excellent.
And leaving Windows 8 in the past. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there are, like all great technology companies, there are the things that are extremely well received and then there are things that you need to improve. You know, and I think I look at Windows 10 and the rate that it's being picked up by consumers, things like Cortana, what we're doing in Office 365.
I know.
Great OEM devices, our partners building amazing devices, the Surface team building amazing devices. You know, we have great software running on great hardware, which is a pretty tough combination to beat.
I was in a Microsoft store. You have one here in the Denver area. And often drop in there when we're in the mall and for various reasons. And the last time I was there, front and center, right on the table next to the concierge, was a Surface Studio. And the gentleman who was the concierge was very kind to kind of walk me through it and give me a demo of it. I told him who I was. And he was great. He was awesome. And I got to take some pictures and touch it and feel it. And I don't know if you know about what I've been writing about, but the Surface Studio sent an earthquake, sent tremors through the Apple community, as far as I can tell. And a whole lot of people said to themselves, this is a bolt from the blue. This is glorious. This is what Apple might have thought about doing. It's basically a 28-inch iPad, and you can touch it, and you can use the Surface dial. And you've got Windows 10 that runs all your apps. Tell me more about the reception to that and how you're feeling about it, if you can.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, the Surface Studio is, like you said, it is a glorious piece of hardware. The display is incredible, that zero gravity hinge. It's phenomenal. And when you put that together with the dial and the pen, you start to see the level of creativity and productivity, that it empowers. I mean, it is a fully functional, high-end Windows PC with an amazing display that, you know, you can lay down into that studio mode. You have a pen that you can draw with, you can write with, the dial, which is contextual to the apps, and you put that together and you see how this becomes this kind of, in my opinion, an unmatched creative tool.
You could even steal a line from Steve Jobs and say the whole is more than the sum of the parts.
That's a very good way to put it. If you just used it as a desktop computer and you just had it sitting there with a mouse and keyboard, it would be phenomenal. When you start using Windows 10 and touch, and you start using ink and pen, and you start using the dial, a whole new world of things, a whole new world of possibilities start to pop up. It is, and it's just so well built and so precisely designed and so precisely engineered. You know, I love the Surface Studio so much, I feel like I'm cheating on my wife. That's the best way I can.
Do you have one in your office?
You know, right now, so in my office, I'll give you the audio tour.
Okay.
I have a Dell workstation desktop, dual Xeon processors under my desk, 32 gigs of RAM. I have three 27-inch HD displays set up, kind of in a command pod style. And then I have a Kinect from my Xbox. I've connected with the Windows adapter for Kinect to do Windows Hello, which is the facial recognition logon system that we have in Windows 10. So I just sit down at my desk, my Kinect recognizes who I am and logs me in securely. I never have to type my password.
Nice. We've heard that Apple is thinking about facial recognition for the iPhone 8. So that seems to be an emerging trend. Can you think of any special advantages for facial recognition over and above touch that make it especially consumer friendly? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think the seamlessness of it, especially when you get into PCs, it's unmatched. I mean, Touch ID on an iPhone is great, right? You use it, you put your thumb on it, and it logs you in. Sitting down at your PC, or in my case here, my desktop PC, or when I flip open my Surface Book, and the second you flip it open, it instantly wakes up from sleep, instantly recognizes who I am, and just unlocks the machine. there's a level of seamlessness to that that touch doesn't necessarily give you. Now, there are touch options for Windows Hello, where you can do a fingerprint reading, which is great, and that works, and it's really, really good, especially if you have a device that doesn't have a Hello-capable camera in it. But that visual ability that, like, the Surface Book, the Surface Pro 4 have, a lot of our new partner devices are starting to include, it's just so seamless because, you know, great technology is great because it works the way you would think it was supposed to work. Like, well, why wouldn't my PC just recognize me and log me in? It's my PC. So right. When you start seeing that kind of seamless nature of the experience, you know, you start resenting every time you have to type in your password, you know, which is it is a level of convenience and fluidity that I don't think you get with anything else.
Yeah, that's right. I agree with you. That's very cool. Well, you know, we were talking about Satya Nadella. One of the things that you mentioned that he's so technical and has brought so much respectability to the company in terms of its approach, its advertising, its maturity as a company, its technical excellence. And one of the things I noticed that I like was as soon as Satya got there, the idea that Microsoft solutions are what's important, not necessarily the operating system or the platform. And so all of a sudden we saw Office on the iPad. We saw the concept of Microsoft products and solutions should be everywhere, even on Linux, if that's what your preferred platform is, as opposed to trying to funnel everything in through Microsoft Windows only to sort of strong arm the customer. That has been a breath of fresh air in my mind. Is that something that, am I characterizing that correctly? And yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
The best way I can put it is if you take a look at the corporate mission, empower every person, organization on the planet to achieve more. There is a beautiful simplicity in that statement, and also a beautiful power in that statement. You know, over a billion people use Windows. People, hundreds of millions of people, might even be over a billion, I'm not sure the exact number, use Office. Millions of people are using our apps and our services. But it becomes about empowering the individual, not about empowering the device that our software runs on. And I think that's an incredibly powerful statement. So Satya bringing that, you know, establishing that mission and then bringing it to life by, you know, building a great version of Office for Mac, building an Office for iPad and for iOS, you know, making sure that Azure is able to connect and empower as many services and people as possible. You know, he's putting that into play so that every person, every organization on the planet can feel like they can achieve more regardless of who they are, where they're from, whatever device they're using. Mm-hmm. If it's powered by Microsoft, they will be able to achieve more than they were able to achieve the day before. And that is a very important, very noble mission. And that's it is the thing that makes me most proud to work here. It's not just the caliber of our products. It's not just selling more stuff. It's the fact that the products and the services that we make and that we sell change people's lives.
We noticed it at Mac Observer right away. Was that something, in your perspectives, I'm not asking you to read his mind, but was that something that Mr. Nadella had a unique perspective on and just brought it lock, stock, and barrel into the company? Or was that concept sort of always there amongst senior management but sort of suppressed by Mr. Bulmer?
I don't know if that's something that you can pin just on Steve. I think that Microsoft has always had the DNA of empowerment in it, and the DNA of working towards a higher purpose. If you look at the amount of money and time and good works that the company does through the giving campaign and a lot of its charitable partnerships, you know, I think that Satya was certainly a catalyst to accelerate that transformation. But I can tell you, as somebody who was here when Steve was in charge and then when Satya was in charge, it's always been there amongst the employees, and it's part of the reason why our products are great, but also that people stay at Microsoft. They're not just staying because they get a good paycheck and they're, you know, they get good benefits, but they're staying because they believe in the company's mission. And that's certainly true for me, and I think it's true for a lot of other people here.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you a couple of key questions before we have to go. I want to ask you about the HoloLens. It's a cool technology. I've seen a lot of demos about it. How do you feel about the, if it's going that way, the transition to a consumerization of it?
I don't work specifically on the product, so I'd hate to speculate too much about it. What I do think is really interesting as a whole is the way that AR and VR are starting to become mainstream. That's really, it's really interesting. I mean, even if you look at the VR space with Oculus and Vive. And
yeah, but those big things that you wear on your face, you know, we tend to think of that as, you know, teenagers in their mom's basement wearing these giant 2-pound things on their face. You don't go out in public with that. I think that's why Apple is going to be doing it on the iPhone display itself rather than something you have to hang on your head. How do you feel about the transition from that kind of technology into the consumer space?
I hear you. I mean, and we've seen moments like this over the course of technology, right? When I got my first cell phone, it was abnormal to see somebody walking down the street with a phone up to their ear. People would look at you and point and stare and be like, what kind of weirdo needs a phone with him 24 hours a day? And now I would bet that both you and I are within arm's reach of our phone and are within arm's reach of our phone 24 hours a day.
Absolutely.
The same thing was said. I mean, back, a computer on every desktop and every home and office, like, that's for weirdos who live in their mom's basements. I'm not going to need a PC. I don't need a Mac. It's like, how many Macs do you have, John? Like 5, 6, 10? I don't know. I mean, like, I've got, just looking around in my office right now, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 working PCs and a MacBook Pro that I keep around to fiddle with. You know, I'm in an office that's probably 15 feet by 15 feet. So it's like, we've seen these kind of
Is this with a touch bar? Did you buy a new one?
I have the previous generation one. I don't have the touch. We have one in the office. It's nice. If you gave me the option between a full touch screen with a pen on a Surface Book that I can detach the screen and a touch bar, I'm going to take the Surface Book every single time. But it's as always, Johnny makes nice stuff. Like, it's a beautiful device. But I think with the AR and the VR thing, you made a really great point, which is like, you got to put this thing on your head. And it's like, as devices start to get slimmer and smaller and more content comes, I think you're going to see a normalization of this. Do I think that, I think Google Glass proved that when you strap something to your face like that and you walk around all the time, society isn't quite ready for that. But in both professional situations and in, home consumer situations, that becomes a lot less scary and a lot more real. So I think that, there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff happening in this space.
Cool. All right. So we have time for one more question. Cortana. Apple and Microsoft view AI agents as something that is in the machine that you're working with. And you can carry that around with you, maybe in your phone or in your desktop. And it's this disembodied voice on your device. Amazon and Google have decided that it's going to be this little device sitting on the desk, which isn't very, very portable, but is always like in the room. You don't have to boot up a machine or log on to your phone. It's just always sitting there listening. If you so elect, you can mute the microphone. Mm-hmm. So how are you feeling about the technical direction that you and Apple are taking as opposed to with Cortana and Siri, as opposed to these desktop devices? Any thoughts?
So I don't have an Echo. I don't have one. I don't have one in my house. It's not something that I've used a little bit. We have one around the office that we play with. A lot of my friends have them, seem to really like them. What I think is interesting about Cortana is Cortana's kind of baked into the fabric of Windows 10. Right? Like, search and Cortana is there. And you can activate Cortana with your voice. You say, "Hey, Cortana," and she pops up and you can ask her questions. And I think we're used to that right now. But you said something about, I have to have my computer, I have to be at my computer, or I have to open up my phone. I think people are used to being able to, like, I unlock my phone and I tap an app and it opens up and it does something. And, you know, the Cortana app for iOS, for Android, is great. I use it every day. They're very good. But what's interesting is that you now have Cortana that's baked into millions and hundreds of millions of PCs all around the world. And as PCs start to take a look at, you know, including things like far-field microphones and broader array microphones, it becomes the kind of thing where you can yell across the room, hey, Cortana, do blah, 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 to your desktop PC or your all-in-one or your laptop, and it wakes up and it does the thing that you need it to do. So there's kind of this interesting thing that's happening where the hardware is improving, Cortana is continuously improving, and it's already there. She is already there helping people across millions and millions of devices.
So Hundreds of millions, yeah.
Yeah, so I like where we are. If you ever want to talk with somebody in Microsoft Research about all the interesting thing that's happening around AI and the bot world and what we're doing, like, there are people who are way, way more competent and speaking about that than I am. But I can tell you that on an average daily basis, I use Cortana on my phone. Oh, she just woke up. Because I said, hey, Cortana.
Hi, so Cortana. How are you?
She's paying attention.
Cortana, turn off Ben's lights.
That's right. That won't work here. I've got to set up all. I use Cortana on my phone. I use Cortana on my Surface Book. Oh, she did it again. I'm going to have to stop saying her name. I use it on my Surface Book. I use it on my desktop PC at work. I use it on my all-in-one at home. That pretty much covers my whole day where I'm able to interact and get assistance from Cortana, whether she's in my pocket or in my laptop bag or on my desk at every phase of my day. Like, she's there to help.
Absolutely. Good point.
That's an omnipresence and a level of convenience and empowerment that is pretty great.
That's cool. Well, thank you for clarifying that. It's interesting to hear your perspective on that. It's a good one. Well, this has been great. We've really run through 41 minutes. We're out of time. I want to thank you. This has been cool.
Well, John, anytime you want to talk, I'm happy to help. We should probably do this more than once every, I don't know, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I might take you up on that introduction to your AI people. So it'd be great to have one of them on the show. All right, cool. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed the discussion with me and Ben. And thank you for coming by. Really appreciate you listening. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.